This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
BFM 89.9, I'm Shoaib Khuttan. With me, Tan Chung Han. And guest hosting with us this morning is Giri Balakrishnan.
Good morning.
Good morning. Good morning. It's the 31st of July. And so we come to the end of another month, which leaves most people speechless. I'm going to go on to the fact that there's a very exciting drama going out there in Indonesia, on the island of Lombok, where they've had that earthquake. You know, we've been focused on that Malaysian who was killed. I think the numbers are now about 16 of people killed during that earthquake. But there were many more Malaysians who were stuck up on the mountain along with almost, I think, 800 hikers that were up on Mount Rinjani that day.
Yeah, I mean, it is a very popular hiking trail. I believe it's a hike that takes a few days, or you have to camp overnight at least, right? And so now the rescue efforts are hampered because a landslide apparently blocked the way down the mountain. So hopefully rescuers and all those hikers that are stuck up there will be able to make it down safe and sound.
I think, you know, some of the latest information, I'm trying to figure out which is the latest information. There's some 180 personnel from the Mount Rinjani National Park Agency and several other agencies, including the Indonesian military, that have formed a rescue team. And they've already started bringing people down. So it's a huge number of people. I said it was over 800. There over 600 of them were foreign nationals, and almost 200 Indonesians. And some of the latest numbers that are being collated, adding to the death toll. So it was the latest casualty was identified as Muhammad Ainul Taksin, 26, from Makassar. He is an Indonesian, and was killed in the earthquake. So yeah, that continues. And if you've ever been, I think, trekking in Indonesia around a volcano, it can be quite dangerous. Yeah. I mean, it's beautiful, but it can be quite dangerous.
Right. And we spoke about this yesterday. You know, there were dozens of aftershocks as well. I mean, some even registering above 5 on the Richter scale. So hopefully there are no more aftershocks. I'm no geologist. I don't know how long these aftershocks last. But hopefully, you know, there'll be no such reoccurrences that could hamper these rescue efforts here.
Yeah, it's pretty frightening kind of situation. I mean, it looks like there's a repeat of a similar kind of emergency situation that we had in Thailand with the boys in the cave, and again now we're being challenged by nature to save another 300 or 400 odd people.
Yeah, I've been to climbing the mountain. I went to Jogja and to it's not Pinatubo. Pinatubo is in the Philippines. So I'm trying to think. It's not Gunung Agung because that's in Bali. But at any rate, the volcanoes are beautiful. And, you know, like you say, Han, you're no geologist and neither am I. But to understand what the Earth is capable of, it's just terrifying, the magnitude of the power and its effects on the landscape.
I mean, have either of you experienced an earthquake at all?
Never.
No? Yeah, neither have I, though. I was in Thailand.
I have. But it was in Myanmar, where I just thought this wooden house that I was staying in, I thought it was a bit odd. I thought maybe somebody was walking very heavily. But then everything swayed. And there's this really strange ocean-like motion that happens with an earthquake. It's not like violent, like somebody holding you by the scruff of your neck and shaking you. It's much more like you feel that things are liquid around you.
Sharad, you sound like going to break out in a nursery rhyme shortly.
Do I? Because I'm full of nursery rhymes. Okay. We'll be back with more. Stay tuned. BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, Joe South and the Believers, and Walk a Mile in My Shoes. I'm Shoaib Khuttan. With me, Tan Chung Han, and guest hosting with us this morning, Giri Balakrishnan. Now, if your kids came up to you and said, I was reading a Bloomberg recently, Dad, and the headline read, reality show fame is more lucrative than an Oxford or Cambridge education. Says, Dad, stop, you know, saving up for that university education. I'm going to just become a reality TV star. What would you say to your child?
Well, firstly, if your kid is reading Bloomberg to begin with, I think you're doing something right. Yeah, you're doing something right. Yeah, you're doing something right there. Yeah. Well, firstly, now whether or not being a reality TV star that's a viable career option, I think that's subject to debate, right? Well, firstly, there's a lot more than meets the eye, but in terms of how much work is actually put into, you know, being on TV and stuff. But I would think that, you know, if done right, this could be a great platform to build a brand for your son or daughter, and then your kid can perhaps leverage on that and then be able to make a name for themselves. I mean, we just spoke about Kylie Jenner, right? She is set to become the youngest billionaire. Why? Because she was able to leverage on her fame from that reality TV show.
So her parents and family were already well-placed for it, right? She's not exactly, self-made and unknown.
But, here she is reaching almost a personal net worth of almost $1 billion by virtue of being on reality TV.
Well, it all really depends. I mean, what is your measure of success? If it's going to be just based on how many dollars or how many ringgit you're sitting on or you're going to earn, then I suppose looking at these kind of options may be the only way to go. Then again, we must always remember to just repeat an often repeated adage, there's no guarantee of success in anything you venture into. It's a lot of hard work, whether it's going to be out of your own talents or from studying in whether it's Oxford or Cambridge or anywhere else.
Yeah, okay. So if I substituted reality TV show for, say, sports the music industry. I mean, is it the same? You know, because in fact, you could make a huge amount of money, much more than you would if you just got a traditional degree and worked for some corporation. If you got into sports, for instance, but because not everybody who gets into sports reaches that level of success, right?
Mm-hmm. I mean, these career pursuits obviously have a track record, right? Be it professional sports or being in the, being an artist or being a good old engineer, doctor, accountant, lawyer, you know, your Asian staples, so to speak.
Yeah, well, think about it, Han. I mean, you know, if we go for the traditional doctor, lawyer, engineer kind of route, let's take the medical industry, for example. To become a doctor, if your child wants to study medicine, you're looking at a cool 1 million ringgit, and that's increasing at a rate of anywhere from 5 to 10% per annum.
Right. And so what this economics consultancy Frontier is saying that apparently contestants on specifically this British reality TV show Love Island, they out-earn graduates from Oxford or Cambridge.
I mean, I think there are several things that are quite annoying here. One is they're clearly above the national average when it comes to good looks, right? So they have nice bodies, they have nice faces, and then they're probably below average in terms of the national IQ. And yet gone on to make so much money. I think that's the most annoying thing, because I don't think you need to be very smart to be in a reality television show, because it's not a quiz, right? It's not the biggest brain of Britain. This is
Love Island.
This is like, who's got a six pack, right? And how many inane things can you say in a minute? So,
Giri, are you noticing a hint of jealousy from Sharad's
just
little rental?
Just
a little bit.
All I can say is, I could have been a contender. I think
there
I can say. Okay. Well, tell us what you think. You can always tweet us at BFM Radio. WhatsApp us at 018-789-8899. Be part of this conversation. BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, Journey with Any Way You Want It. I'm Sharad Kutin, with me at Tan Chung Han, and guest hosting with us this morning, Giri Balakrishnan. Very interesting ways in which economists think about the world. We have this article that suggests that in California, where beaches can be quite dirty, they've actually put a number to how much people will be willing to put out in order to have their beaches restored to their pristine condition. So they've actually, made a calculation in California, apparently, to see 25% less trash on the beach, Californians are willing to pay up to $13 a year, whereas for a 75% reduction, they're willing to pay up to $43 a year.
That's a bit, it's interesting to see that people are actually willing to pay X amount of money to ensure that the beaches are clean, but it also reflects on poor social responsibility. I mean, we are paying basically, or whoever it is who is choosing to pay that amount of money is basically paying for somebody else's mess.
I do think, though, you know, many beaches are littered from debris from the sea. So, yes, there might be stuff that comes from people littering and not picking up after themselves, you know, after a picnic. But the nature of beaches are such that even in places where people are very responsible, you know, plastics and all kinds of debris comes in from the sea. So, okay, so let's put that aside as to the cause of it. The issue really here is that what are you willing to pay for the improvements of public spaces? Yes, we pay taxes. We pay taxes perhaps at several levels of government. But in addition to that, would you put out money for a better environment?
Well, I guess the cheap person that I am, I would say no. I would just try to drive a little bit further and find a cleaner spot. And I guess this is where consumer behavior, consumer power, so to speak, comes into play, because you know, you have options. Now, if you're talking about the only stretch of beach available to the local community and it's just totally littered, and then this is where, you know, local councils can then come in and use the tax money that I've already been paying to make sure that they clean up.
Yeah. Well, you know, Han, you should let's localize it. I mean, I've been to Port Dickson, like most Malaysians have many times, mm-hmm. and we've been to a few stretches, and they all seem to be pretty much the same. You right. know, so it's not like as if you can say, okay, let's decide that it's not clean enough for us. We're going to drive up to, where's your next beach? It's Penang.
Well, I mean, or you just don't go to the beach, right?
And okay.
People make those options all the time. Morib and Port Dickson were, you know, not seen as an ideal. Yeah, exactly. There we go. Exactly.
It's still a beach.
Well, exactly. So, because of the deteriorating conditions of those beaches, you know, people just moved away.
Okay, let's put your hat on as an economist, right? So you say to an individual like Han, who says, okay, I have a local beach. It would cost me 20 ringgit a year to have the beach restored to a level that would make you satisfied. But you said, no, I don't want to spend 20 ringgit. I'm going to drive to the next beach. But if I told you as an economist, it's going to cost you 15 ringgit, in petrol to drive to the next beach, then the difference is only 5 ringgit between getting your local beach cleaned up or going to the next clean beach. Now, what would you choose? Because there's opportunity cost. And so an economist would actually put a price on that choice that you've made about driving to the next beach.
So would you think that maybe a pay-per-use idea might work better and keep these beaches clean? Then at least the monies that are collected can be used to employ people to ensure that the beaches are kept at a particular standard.
Yeah, well, then you automatically raise the barrier of entry, literally, to nature, right? And you don't want to be setting the bar too high here. I mean, again, these are meant to be communal grounds, and you would think that the local government is able to do that. Okay, so given those options, those very limited options that you painted there, Sherrod, yeah, well, I guess then we'll be forced to pay a certain amount, if there's this unyielding desire to go to the beach.
Then. Well, yeah, I mean, the thing about economists and that kind of thinking is that they're actually telling you many of the choices you make. In fact, all the choices you make come with certain costs, mm-hmm. right? Yeah. And so, the cost could be in, and ultimately, it could all be costed in terms of money, but because we sometimes think of time and so on. So going to the next beach might be a great option, mm-hmm. a cheaper option in your mind, because you're thinking, I don't have to pay, I don't have to put out cash immediately. But you might actually lose it in terms of time. So it might take you an extra hour. And what does that hour cost you, right? And what does it mean to you in terms of value?
Economy and going to a beach. Well, think about it. What about public swimming pools as opposed to becoming a member of a club and using the swimming pool in a club? I mean, there's vast differences between the standards of one and the other. Again, we're looking at the same kind of comparison, really, aren't we?
Well, not quite, because you then have that level of exclusivity to the private club, right? With beaches, you know, how do you actually go about what trying to lend that level of exclusivity? I mean, I guess we do that to a certain extent when we go to some fancy hotel and they've got private beaches for that hotel, and you're paying for the pristine nature of that beach via the elevated hotel rates, right? I guess there'll be a better comparison, you know? But then again, that comes with the hotel stay. In and of itself, would I be willing to pay just to use the beach? I'm good.
Okay, that's the world.
I'm a mountain kind of guy, anyways.
Okay, Mr. Tan's weighed in on the reality TV star option for young people, and he says the fact remains that it takes many more failures to make a few success stories. Hence, it isn't a good strategy for a career choice. I think, Mr. Tan, you're very wise and your children are very lucky. We're coming up to the first bulletin of the morning, and we have Natalie Imbruglia with A Wrong Impression. Stay tuned. BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9. I'm Sharad Kutin with me, Tan Chung Han, and guest hosting with us this morning is Giri Balakrishnan. That was Deborah Harry with I Want That Man. Now, in Kota Kinabalu recently, victims of a fire was viewed in a video clip throwing away clothes that were sent to them out of charity, right? So people sent them clothes because they had been victims of this fire, and they seemed not to like the clothes. And at any rate, whatever the motivations of those involved, that video clip went viral, and netizens, yes, the people that exist on planet Net, were very unhappy.
You know, it's strange because the people say, you know, a picture says 1,000 words. Sometimes the interpretation of these pictures can be very, very wrong. Mm. You know, very often we have a situation like this where people have generously and selflessly donated something because they care for these people. What happens if it doesn't fit, or it's torn, or it's in bad condition, or, you know, it's not usable? There are situations very often where people use these occasions to dump things that they would otherwise have to, at some expense, dispose of.
Right. And you've got to consider the motivations of those who perhaps commented on this video, or perhaps showed some ire against those who, those would-be recipients of those clothes which were thrown away, right? Because when you, you know, perform some good deed, an act of kindness, do you often do it without any expectation of gratitude or anything in return?
Altruism. You want to do something because you feel it's the right thing to do, not because you want someone to come back and say, thank you, well done, you know, we really appreciate what you've done for me.
Well, you know, in this instance, it wasn't so much that people weren't outwardly grateful. They might have been. It's just that the video showed them to be much more, perhaps, picky about what they would take as objects of charity. They were perhaps less accepting of everything that was thrown their way, right? So it could be that for somebody who's the giver, they wouldn't have encountered a lack of gratitude directly for themselves. But what they viewed was something how would you characterize that behavior? It's a behavior where people are actually still making choices for themselves. And I think that's something that people who are the givers often forget, that the people they're giving things to are still human beings who are still making choices about their lives, right? And they're not just going to be saying, well, give me everything, thank you very much.
Well, I guess the idea that may, again, I'm trying to get into the mind of these netizens here. I guess the idea at play here is that, well, I mean, not to say that they are beggars, but for lack of better terms, beggars can't be choosers. So if they're in a predicament, hey, we're helping you best we can, and perhaps show a bit more gratitude. Now, again, Giri, you're absolutely right. The context of this video, we don't know the true context, but perhaps just to help us consider the other side of the equation here, should those recipients perhaps been a bit more mindful about the optics of what they were doing?
Well, you can always be part of this conversation. Remember, you can tweet us at BFM Radio. And then, or WhatsApp us at 018-789-8899. Leave your name. Remember, it's Malaysia Baru. You don't have to be scared. Put your name there.
Yeah, I'm just thinking out aloud. Put ourselves in a situation where you receive X number of the same items. What would you do? You would You would give it up to somebody else, you know, who may not have, for example.
Okay, let me paint you another scenario here, okay? Let's say you've got a packet of chicken rice in your hand and you see a homeless person there, right? And you give that man this pack of chicken rice and he says, no thanks. Or he takes it and just, you know, chucks it off to the side.
Or what if he takes it and just eats the chicken that he likes and eats half the rice and discards the rest?
Right. Or say, ini tak sedap lah. Right? So then what happens then? Like, do you then...
Well, see, this is very interesting because when I was a child and I gave money to some lady who looked like she was a vagrant, and I was very concerned when I came back home and I told my mother, maybe she's using it to drink, because I kind of suspected she might be alcoholic. And my mother said, it didn't really matter. It says, if you want to give, you give. But don't expect to change people's lives or make demands on their lives. Now that you've given your 20 cent, you can now determine how they live their lives. I mean, my mother, spoke truth to me, I think at that point in time, about what happens when I give. What kind of power do I assume to for myself when giving in an act of charity?
I think that's exactly it, Charles. It's like, there's some hidden or unwritten rule somewhere which says that if I give, you must take or you must use. I mean, I don't think that's really the whole idea here.
Right.
You're providing because you feel that person needs something and you give what you can.
Yeah. I personally agree with you guys, and I was raised with those same values as well. But I wonder if that is actually being eroded, because I had this experience recently with a student of mine, right? And so I spoke about, I'm just assuming, in moral class, we learn that if you see a beggar, you try and help them. And a couple of my students were shocked. That was the first time they're hearing it. Why? Because they've been told all their lives, all 13 years of their lives, that never, ever give alms to the poor. Why? Because of the concerns that you mentioned just now, Shira. And it's like, they might use it for gambling and whatnot. So that appears to be the mindset that's being passed on to kids nowadays. So, quite this seismic change in terms of the values that we were imparted with versus the current generation.
I know. Beggars going off to buy dodgy equities. I mean, so many things can go wrong. Okay, stay with us. BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, Supertramp and Breakfast in America. I'm Tan Chung Han. No, I'm not. He's Tan Chung Han. I'm Sharad Kutin. And guest hosting this morning is Giri Balakrishnan.
See, he just wants to be me, Giri.
I do. When I grow up and a little fatter, I want to be Tan Chung Han. Thank you so much, Hiswani, for your tweet in about altruism. You say, in Islam, you are rewarded for your intent and effort, not for the outcome, as the outcome is beyond your control. So don't be holier than thou and think you're better than the people you help, and don't assume things about the lives of others. That's an interesting perspective.
Yeah, and this also ties in with the episode involving the Johor Prince. Remember, he went to this supermarket, made this huge announcement, okay, everybody free groceries. Now, his intent was obviously there, but then look at the outcome, and he was actually chastised for the outcome, right? So should this standard be applied there as well?
Maybe, yeah.
Question mark.
Sorry, Han, I want to ask you, the intent being?
Oh, he wanted to give out free groceries to a whole bunch of shoppers.
So there was an intention to...
Yeah. Well, the intention might have been, gaining political capital.
Yeah. Wow.
But because that was also perhaps an instance of not knowing what the average, grocery shopping bag consisted of. Because he gave just too much money.
Yeah, $3,000.
Well, he created chaos. Okay, one of something that irks me endlessly is the fact that when we talk about sports, we only ever talk about football. So even the newly minted Minister of Sports and Youth is constantly talking about the fate of Malaysian football, as if there are no others sporting activities in this country that need support and need investment in.
It's only the world's most popular game, but yes, go on.
Yes, and big money is behind it, and that's why it gets all this attention, quite out of out of proportion to the reality of what sports are, But anyway, that's just my opinion. The Prime Minister, Dr. Mahathir, has weighed in on football himself and suggested that he thinks it's okay for naturalized foreign players to be part of the national team in order to enhance the performance of what we dub Harimau Harimau Malaysia or Harimau Malaya, I think it's called Malaya, and others of course are weighing in on that. We got in touch with Harish Dale. He's a sports journalist and editor of 2213, and asked him whether we should look up or should look to bring in naturalized players.
Should we bring in naturalized players? I insist once again, it is an option, but it is not the solution at this moment. The solution is by investing in the grassroots. Let's try that instead of, you know, spending big money on these foreigners whom we don't know whether they will work or not. You invest in grassroots, maybe you may get a good player, but maybe you may get a good official. You may get a good referee. You see, because they will be part of the whole ecosystem, the football ecosystem. But if you invest in a player, you're just investing in him and him alone. It doesn't guarantee that the other players, the locals, will actually learn a thing or two from this particular player.
That was Harish Dale, sports journalist and editor of 2213.
No, it's a simple equation, really. If you're looking at it from the perspective of what kind of talents or skill sets we have currently in Malaysia, if we just don't have it, there's no reason why we shouldn't import it. We have similar kind of situation even in the corporate world as well. When we don't have the necessary talent to run a particular kind of organization, we bring in an expat, people who have the kind of skill sets that we need to develop that organization.
Right, but the difference here is that those expats aren't necessarily competing in the corporate sector while waving the national flag or having to embody this sense of national identity, right? Look, I totally appreciate and I agree with the context there that we just heard from Harish Dale, but in and on itself, the policy about bringing in naturalized players onto the Harimau Malaya team, I actually agree with the Prime Minister here, and I agree that there is room for that. There are so many high-profile cases at this past World Cup. You got Diego Costa, right? Striker, star striker for the Spanish team. He was born in Brazil. You've got French players who actually played not just for France, but other World Cup teams as well, representing Europe, Africa, South America. Well, those are continents, obviously. So, you know, it is not the norm. It is not the exception, really.
The question is, should we take nationalism out of sports? Should we, in the worst aspects of nationalism, which is the promotion of your country over other countries, you know, the kind of chest beating and thumping that goes on with wins? Because I think what often happens is when we think about improving a sport, we think in terms of medals and those kinds of performance KPIs, rather than think about how universalized access to sport is, how much it's in the curriculum, so people develop healthy lifestyles, do they, you know, learn how to follow rules and be gentlemanly, or, you know, there might be a gender-neutral expression for gentlemen, you know, sportsman-like behavior, whatever it is, all the great stuff of sports without the chest thumping.
Can you share natural talent? I suppose that's another question that we can really think about as well. You can't bring in a Diego Maradona and expect him to be able to impart his skill sets to somebody else and create a little Diego Maradona, can you?
Well, no, I disagree. I think you very much can. And like you see these clubs bringing in these talismen into their clubs. Why? So that the younger players can then learn from these more established professionals. Eric Cantona, great example there. You know, he was there just as the class of 92 was rising through the ranks in Manchester United. Yes, I'm indulging in this Manchester United folklore here, but that's a classic example of how others can learn from these very talented individuals.
It's a big conversation and it's going to carry on. So remember, you can be part of it. Tweet us at BFM Radio. WhatsApp us at 018-789-8899. We're going up to the next bulletin of the morning and taking us there, The Heavy, with How You Like Me Now. Stay tuned, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.